Spring is in the air at Littleton Coin Company, and we want to help you brighten your collection. Visit us at littletoncoin.com all month long to enjoy 15% off your purchase. With a wide selection of coins, paper money, supplies, and more, Littleton Coin Company has something for every collector's taste. Use promo code SPRING at littletoncoin.com for 15% off your purchase all month long. Restrictions apply. Littleton Coin Company. Serving collectors since 1945.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
Today's podcast is sponsored by my new favorite animated TV show, Tuttle Twins, the first cartoon series to teach kids principles of freedom, economics, and liberty, and to be funny in the process. Nowadays, hidden political agendas are constantly forced on your kids in entertainment and in schools. Tuttle Twins is a hilarious cartoon series that teaches kids about the principles of freedom without being overly preachy. It's educational and hilarious, and there are lots of jokes for adults too. The best part, you can watch Tuttle Twins entirely for free. Just go to TuttleTwins.tv, that is Tuttle Twins, TuttleTwins.tv, and over there you can watch all of the episodes for free. One more time, that's TuttleTwins.tv. Highly recommend it, go check it out. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we are going to be talking to an awesome guy. He has been in the world of trading for many, many years. And this is the one and only Peter Brandt. Welcome to the show.
Golly. I can't believe that we're here face to face because we have gone back and forth on Twitter. We've touched base, right? We've direct tweeted, we've commented on each other's tweets, and I tried to get you. I so much wanted to get you to Tucson. I really believe I could have filled up my house with people. You would have had a place to stay. I would have heated the pool. I would have introduced you to all my friends, and it would have been great to have had you here. I'm sure and you have got to come and see the desert in Tucson. We're in the Sonoran Desert, which is really neat. This is not like the desert that you picture in Africa. This is vegetation. We are crazy right now with wildflowers on our cactus. We have deserts that are just filled with the saguaro cactus, which is the beautiful cactus that has all of the arms sticking out, and they're huge, and it's just pretty. The desert here is just a wonderful place, pretty place. And it would have been more pretty with the face of Zuby here too, as well. Yeah.
I'm so honored. Thank you very much, Peter. I appreciate that. So for people who aren't familiar with you, Peter, please tell them a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a young guy, you know, in my mid-20s, I lived in Chicago, got introduced to the world of trading grains, became a member of the Chicago Board of Trade. And this is, you know, this is like 1975. Started trading grains. And I've been basically a gambler. I think of myself as a grain trader or a trader of commodities. But I think for most people who don't understand that, I place bets. I place bets on the price of the British pound. I have a bet right now on the price of the British pound. I place bets on crude oil, on gold, on corn, on interest rates, on the U.S. stock market, on the Japanese stock market. And it's what I've done basically to earn my living ever since 1975. I've been a commodity speculator, a speculator in the commodity futures markets. And then I got talked into writing a book in 2011 by a very respectable publishing house in the United States, John Wiley and Sons. And I wrote a book on my trading called The Diary of a Professional Commodity Trader. I'm not hawking books, by the way. If they want to buy a book, you buy stuff from Zuby. I mean, I'll show you what the Zuby Library is here.
Awesome.
Okay, I don't know. That kind of has a glare to it, but we've got them all.
Man, I'm honored.
Yeah, I mean, that's not it. We've got more here, folks. I mean, and the greatest and latest, right?
Anyone who's listening to just the audio, Peter has all of my albums, and he's holding them up to the camera right now.
Yeah, I mean, my grandkids, they come over and they sleep over because we help kind of shuttle the grandkids around. We've got two grandsons here in Tucson. We've got three more in Minnesota where we spend 5 months of the year. And they come over and kind of we restrict their listening. But they can recite the words to Zuby. You know, hey, I became a hip hop artist. I know fans through you. I never listened to hip hop music before you, right? But you know, okay, dude, and you know they know the words and they come over and they sing them and along with you, and you know. So I wrote this book in 2011, thinking nobody's going to want to read anything about what I do, and lo and behold, it becomes the best-selling finance book on Amazon for like 25 straight weeks. Wow. I'm going, who are these people around the world? I mean, it ends up getting translated into 7 or 8 different languages. And each time it gets translated, I'm going, you know, how in the world do they know about this old guy who lives in the United States? And so then the publisher set me up on Twitter. And I happened to be lucky enough to make some huge calls on the market. You know, the top in 2011 in silver at $50, and you know, and I'm pretty outspoken on Twitter, kind of like you, but maybe not as outspoken. at least on the same issues, right?
Yeah.
So I developed this huge Twitter following, and you know, I've got like 650,000 followers on Twitter, and you know, which kind of makes my grandkids brag me up. They go, oh, I got a grandpa who's got 600,000 followers on Twitter, and I don't know who these people are, and I don't know why they follow me, to tell you the truth. But you know, I discovered you on Twitter, and I don't know how that is, right? I mean, you run across somebody and I go, boy, this is an interesting guy. And you know, it ends up that you're vocal on a lot of the same issues I'm vocal on, although I make an exception. Primarily, I want to tweet about markets, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's my deal. And so I will come in and I'll make comments on social and political issues. As a rule, I generally, you know, I generally take them down and delete them after 24 hours or so, only because I want to keep my Twitter feed kind of clean, mm-hmm. based on the reasons why I really want people to follow me. Or I see stuff by you or other people and I retweet it. And again, after a period of time, I generally will delete my retweet again. Mm-hmm. So I kind of look at myself in terms of the issues that you care about and I care about, as kind of guerrilla warfare, right? Like the Vietnamese, the way they fought the Americans. You come in and you blast it, and then you retreat back into the forest. And so on Twitter, that's kind of the way I am, whether it's on gender issues or race issues or COVID or Joe Biden Kamala Harris or whatever it is. I kind of come in and I take a shot, and I'm like the Viet Cong, and you know, I pull the trigger a few times, and then you know, I retreat back into the jungle and pull some charts on the chart of the S&Ps. So that's the way it is. And I've just, you know, it hey, I mean, I started following you, I think, you know, I don't know, maybe early COVID, right? 2020. Mm-hmm. And there's so much you and I can talk about here. What a crazy 2 years. I mean, is there, I'm mid 70s. I'm not going to give you an age because that's protected interest. If I knew you better, I would. Let's just say I'm going on 80s, you know. Okay. I mean, the next big mark for me is 80s. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's been another 2 years that I've been alive where so much has happened, right? I mean, you have the craziness of COVID, you have Donald Trump, you have the whole racial stuff take place in the United States, you've got the war in Ukraine, you've got inflation, you've got gender confusion, you've mm-hmm. got, you know, the number of things that are taking place. It's just a crazy time.
And do you think it's sorry to jump in. Do you think it's more than ever before, or do you think it's that we're seeing it and that we're able to just have so much information in front of us? What do you think? What's the balance on that?
No, I think it's more than ever before, but yeah. You know, it's kind of like the pace of learning, right? They say knowledge now doubles every X amount of time, and mm-hmm. you know, the rate of change and the rate of discovery on medical breakthroughs is accelerated. I just think we live in a world where, you know, we've all got on the treadmill and we've increased the speed of the treadmill, and once we increase the speed of the treadmill, you either got to hop off or you got to keep pace. And mm-hmm. just the pace of things happening is in faster than it's ever happened before.
I hear that. So Peter, I'm interested to know how do you get into the world of trading to begin with? You summarized it really briefly, but it's something you got into as a young man. So what exactly was it that led you down that rabbit hole and kept you there?
Well, you know, I worked in advertising. I worked for what became the largest advertising firm in the world, Omnicom. I think headquartered actually now in the UK, but at the time it was Needham Harper and Steers, became Needham DBH. But you know, massive accounts, and that was what I studied in college. And so, you know, Minnesota, born and raised in Minnesota, lived in Minnesota. Had a family super young. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had my wife was a teenage mother and I was still in the middle of college. And, you know, we had kids and I worked my way through college with three jobs. And so we moved to Chicago and I met a guy through youth sports, actually. It was my older son was playing hockey. I met another father. He was a trader at the Chicago Board of Trade. And I knew nothing about that other than he said, come on down, have lunch with me in the members' dining room on the fifth floor of the Chicago Board of Trade, overlooking the fourth floor and the trading pits. And people are yelling and screaming and fist fights break out. And it's crazy. And I just went like, wow, I found my place in the world. This I don't know anything about it. I don't know how it's going to work. But I really want to try this. And so I approached the advertising firm at the time, Needham Harper and Steers. And I approached Dick Needham and said, hey, I want to, I was on the young guy fast track. And I said, hey, I want to try going to be the board of trade. If I blow out, if I can't make it, will you hire me back in a year for a 20% raise? And he said yes. And so I kind of had the freedom to fly, right? I mean, if I fell off the high wire, there was a net underneath me. And so I learned the business, and you know, which took me longer than I really thought. You know, I thought, hey, I'm smart, I work hard, this is going to come to me. I found that the wall of learning was a little steeper than I had thought. And, you know, it took me a few years to get there. I save up a little money, put it in an account and blow it out. I think I blew out 2-3 accounts before I finally found my stride. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of young people, you know, through the Robinhood, in the United States. I mean, we're seeing the younger generation get into market speculation, you know, through cryptos or through these crazy stocks like GameStop or whatever it is. So we've seen a whole new generation of people come in and become interested in market speculation, which is really what it was for me, but it was speculation through commodity markets, which for the most part, it still is. And I just finally figured out that, you know, I could make a living. I could make a living by buying and selling live cattle or treasury bonds or British pounds or Swiss francs or corn. And so that's pretty much now what I've done. There was a brief period of time when I really burned out. I mean, because it's pretty intense. I mean, being a trader is an intense deal. And, you know, after I had been in the business like 20 years, I had burnt out and I kind of took a sidetrack and became active in kind of political issues, became an NGO at the United Nations. And so I kind of took a lobbyist in Washington, really on issues that you blog about. You know, a lot of the things you blog about, I was interested in back then. I'm a libertarian, I'm a conservative, I'm a Christian. And so I took the little side path, a sidebar in my life for a decade, and then came back in and have traded since. And we have, you know, it's a I have a global trading firm. We've, you know, we've got a presence in Europe. I actually have an office in Bulgaria. I have a trader in Bulgaria. We have, we're headquartered in Milwaukee. I kind of go back and forth between Minneapolis and Tucson, and we've got an office in Manhattan, and we trade these crazy markets. And I, like you, just kind of can't keep my finger away from pushing tweet. And more often than not, it's, you know, as you know, it's controversial. You went through that. I'd like to hear about that, where you kind of got down for a bit. And I could relate to that, where you put something out that you sincerely believe in, you, it makes sense to you, and you just get slammed by the trolls. and you got down and even questioned, should I even continue on Twitter?
When are you referring to? Are you referring to recently? Or,
you know, I think 2020. I think you went through a period in 2020 where you became a little bit discouraged. Now, I think even expressed on Twitter, is, should you keep doing this in light of the fact that you just, you know, people just slam you for some of the things you were saying.
And I'm trying to remember this specific moment, because I don't think I've ever had a time where I thought of leaving. I've certainly had moments. I mean, I've faced tons and tons of backlash. I've certainly had moments where I'm just like, oh my gosh, what is going on now? Like, what is this landmine that I've stepped on that's exploded? Or, you know, people of all sorts of different groups of people have, you know, decided to direct their vitriol at me at different times. It's rare for it to ever last more than 48 hours. So you kind of just have to weather the storm whenever that happens. But, you know, before any of the internet stuff, I mean, I used to sell my CDs on the street. Not everyone knows that. So some of those CDs you got there, you know, I built up my audience in the UK from, you know, starting in 2006. And, you know, I was selling my stuff directly to the public hand to hand until late 2018. So for many years, I was just out on the street. And then eventually I started doing pop-up shops. So I've spoken to hundreds of thousands of people, and I've sold tens of thousands of copies of my CDs hand to hand. So I've faced all kinds of love, hate, positivity, negativity, praise, criticism, hate, all of that. I've had that face to face even. So when it comes to the online stuff, you know, there's not really much anyone can say to me that I haven't experienced already at this point. So sometimes it gets annoying. Sometimes it gets frustrating. Sometimes it feels like the negative is outweighing the positive temporarily. But that's usually just an illusion. In the real world and also online, the amount of love and appreciation and kindness and generosity has been phenomenal. I mean, I can go to most, you know, any decent sized city in the USA and organize a meetup, and, you know, 100 people will show up, and, you know, at late notice, and we'll just hang out and have good conversations. And wherever I go now, whatever city I'm in, even different countries, you know, I've had people stop me on the street in many places, you know, of course, all over the UK and the US, but in Turkey and Mexico, in places, you know, just people recognize me. Oh yeah, like, I follow you online, you know, I follow you on Twitter or on Instagram, or I listened to your podcast, checked out your music, whatever it is. I'm always just trying to offer things that help motivate and inspire other people and encourage people to think. And I love human beings as much as they can be frustrating. You know, I think people are both the best and worst thing in the world, but I want people to fulfill their potential or strive to.
Mm-hmm.
We can all be better mentally, physically, spiritually, relationally, how we communicate, how we interact. I'm not perfect. Nobody is, but I'm always striving to make myself better. And in doing so, I can set an example and also create stuff, whether it's music, whether it's podcasts, whether it's public speaking, whether it's books. I've got my first children's book coming out in July, which is exciting.
Oh, so, wow. Yeah,
anything I can do that will help people based on my talents and interests, then that's what I'm about. That's essentially my life mission. So, you know, and God is always with me. So even when certain humans get mad at me, you know, God is there. I've got my family. I've got my friends as well.
So it
keeps me grounded.
That's a great safety net. So I'm curious. So, you know, I know that you have some other business interests. Of course, you want to sell your music and, you know, you speak and you do things like that. Did it help your record sales when you became the female world record holder of the deadlift?
it definitely. I mean, Peter, you know, when I tweeted that, so that tweet was February 26, 2019. So just over 3 years ago. When I posted that tweet, I'd been on Twitter for 10 years and I had about 18,000 followers at the time. Today as we record this, I'm at 760,000, and that's just on Twitter. Across all the social media platforms, I had about 50,000 followers, and now it's about 1.3 million.
Amazing.
All organic. So the growth over the past couple of years has been, it's been crazy, you know, and it's led to more people listening to and, you know, checking out my music, but it's just grown. It's grown everything, and it's led to this huge world of opportunities. The problem always used to be not having enough opportunities. Now the problem is having too many and not being able to manage all of the bandwidth. But that's a beautiful position to be in. So I've worked very hard to get here. It's been well over 15 years, and I've still got a long way to go. But I feel grateful every single day.
Well, you're making it. You know, you're an inspiration to a lot of people. And I'm not, you know, I'm sure that you've heard people say that, but you really are. You've inspired me in a lot of ways.
Thank you.
And, you know, so, yeah, you know, some of the things you post are fun and, you know, they're meant to be fun. Some are serious comedy or parodies on the world. When you were the female deadlift world record holder, would you have imagined then that the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA in the United States, would award the national swimming record to somebody that the Babylon Bee reported was using in, you know, a performance enhancing testicles? Seriously, was that the logical conclusion of you being the deadlift champion?
It was. I mean, that's why I posted that video back in 2019, because I saw this issue coming, I want to say from 2015, 2016. I saw this coming, and I remember having conversations with people about this in 2016, 2017, saying that this was going to happen. And like with many things, until it happens, people think that you're being silly, or that you're being a so-called conspiracy theorist, or that, come on, Zooey, that's not going to happen. Like that's too silly. And I'm like, look, this is the logical conclusion of it. And there had been certain incidents that had happened in mixed martial arts. There'd been a biological male fighter who had, you know, smashed up a couple of women. There had been a few things popping up in athletics and in various sports. And so I had my eye on that. And then, that's what spurred me to create the video. And then I was like, oh, let me just put this out there. I didn't know it was going to explode internationally in the way that it did. I just posted it there. Just like, you know, as you say, when you're on Twitter, sometimes if you're active on there, I post a dozen, two dozen tweets a day. As they come to my mind, and I'm not sitting there plotting, thinking, okay, this one definitely is going to be the one that's going to introduce me to millions of people. That's not what I thought.
Yeah.
I just thought this is funny and, you know, it's making me laugh and it's interesting and it's relevant. So I just put it out there, and within about 10 minutes, I think the video had over 10,000 views. Within an hour, I think it had broken 100,000. And from then on, it just took on a life of its own. And that happens sometimes, and it can be difficult to manufacture. I'm a musician, right? I would love to have a song that I can just put out, one song, and boom, it just attracts the attention of millions of people. But it's not easy to manufacture these moments, and you sort of have to tap into the zeitgeist. And sometimes it's a matter of the timing and the framing and the wording and whether or not something has a video that can make anything go viral.
Yep. So, yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I know that on Twitter, I'll put something out, and you know, I'm a chartist. I draw funny lines on price graphs. That's what I do. And I'll put in something out there, and I found that the crypto nerds particularly like to throw hate at me if I make any suggestion that maybe the price of their cryptos is going to decline. And somebody will tweet at me and say, "You're just an old white boomer." And to which I respond, actually, I self-identify as a 19-year-old pregnant lesbian black lady. And because, you know, hey, you can self-identify any way you want now. Mm-hmm. But hey, I've got a question for you. Had you been to the United States for any length of exposure prior to your trip?
Yeah, I've been to the U.S. maybe in total, probably about six to eight times in my life. I first came to the USA, I think, when I was 4 years old. I remember going to Florida with my family when I was four, and then used to have an uncle that lived in Indiana, so came to Indiana a couple times. Came to Boston, came to New York once for an event, and then in 2019, I came to Chicago in 2008 because I had some training for my corporate job I was doing at the time. And then the first sort of solo trip I did to the U.S. as an adult was in 2019. Yeah. That was after this thing blew up. And then that was the first time I went on Joe Rogan, and I went on the Rubin Report, the Ben Shapiro Show, and many other big platforms. And then I was going to come back in 2020, but the world decided to shut down entirely. So
yeah.
I had to cancel my 2020 trips. But then mid-2021, I came back out and spent a few months here, and then I've got a US visa now. So yeah, I can be here now indefinitely for the next few years if I choose to. So
So we through our church and through the because of the civil war that was taking place in Ethiopia back, you know, in the 1980s, early 1990s, we adopted a young African-American boy who we got to the United States through the Red Cross. They brought him over here through, got him out of the country, went through Switzerland, into Boston, into northern Minnesota, arrived in northern Minnesota, didn't speak a word of English, didn't have a coat on his back. It was 30 below. And so, here in a small town, my exposure, I've never considered myself a racist. And of course, we're living through a period where accusations of racism are thrown around like crazy here, not only in the U.S., but around the world, of course. But I'm curious on your trips to the U.S., particularly in the last couple of years. I just don't see America as this. Certainly there are racist people in it. There are racist people everywhere. There mm-hmm. are racist blacks toward whites. There mm-hmm. are racist this toward that. Racist men toward women, women toward men, class toward class.
Yeah.
But I just have never, and maybe I'm just have missed the ball completely. I just have never felt like either I or my family or my neighbors or my country is this mm-hmm. big racist entity. And I'm wondering in your trips how you kind of read things.
Man, I've been, the USA is one of my favorite countries. I've had zero racist experiences at any time in my life within this country. I've been embraced by, I mean, it's quite the opposite, right? The amount of love I get in this country is insane. So, you know, I think it's interesting because the same thing happens in the UK. And I think when it comes to both the UK and the USA, you know, the greatest critics of the nations are, you know, are people with it within the countries themselves. And oftentimes people are comparing to a perfect human utopia that doesn't exist and has never existed when they're making some of these charges and claims. The exact same thing happens in the UK, by the way. People will say, oh, you know, the UK is a racist country. Or people say that the USA is a racist country. Some people will even go as extreme as saying the USA is the most racist country in the world, which is a telltale sign that they have not been anywhere and don't know anything about the world. These are nonsensical terms. I mean, if you compare, I mean, the question is always compared to what, right? Both in terms of history and also in terms of world geography, right? So if someone wants to make the claim that, you know, the USA is a very racist country, it's like, okay, well, what are you comparing to, right? Everyone acknowledges that there are racist people, right? Racist people exist, racist ideas exist. It's not remotely unique to any country. You can travel across Africa, you can travel across Asia, you can, the Middle East, South America, any part of the world, and you will find that there are examples of racism or ethnic tribalism or xenophobia and so on. In fact, if you go to many of those countries, you can go to places, you know, across Africa, and where to an outsider, the citizens of that nation might look the same to you, and the levels of tribalism or racism in between some of those ethnicities within the same country is far more severe than any type of moderate racism that exists in the modern UK or modern US. So when people make those type of claims, they're either based in naivety or ignorance, or sometimes just malice, because they, you know, you can acknowledge the existence of something without massively exaggerating the reality of it. And I don't think it's fair to the people of those countries to paint this picture that, you know, they're these horrible places to live. They look at it, and it doesn't matter. I mean, what makes the USA and UK special is that regardless of who you are, regardless of your nationality, skin color, ethnic background, religion, gender, sexuality, so on and so forth, that in this modern era, right now in 2022, no matter where you fit in those categories, there aren't going to be very many places in the world that are going to treat where the people and even the laws are going to treat you as strive to treat you as fairly and equally as possible. So I reject those notions. I think there are a lot of people in our society right now in different countries who enjoy being agitators and who enjoy enjoy painting people as these villains and having these ideas in their head and spreading this sort of fear and negativity and division and polarization and so on. Oftentimes it's their whole career, and I don't think it's accurate, and I don't think it's helpful. I think if the goal is to, you know, have a more positive and cohesive society, then yes, it's good to identify problems and issues as they arise or where they might be. It's interesting. It's good to shine a spotlight on them when there are certain incidents that happen, but you don't want to paint with such a broad brush that it makes it sound like everybody or the entire system or the entire society is some terrible thing that it's not.
Oh, no, I agree. And, you know, politically, I'm a libertarian.
Sure.
Which I think plays itself out in how I look at some social issues and a lot of things. So, hey, you know, I'm not enamored with the Republican Party in the United States. But I will tell you, the loony left here in the United States, it's crazy. You look at the reaction to the whole Twitter thing, right? Mm. The whole Twitter thing. It's loony. It's lunatic. And, you know, personally, I think it's good that, you know, Elon Musk has bought Twitter. I think, I think people will see that as time goes on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there is a left-leaning media here. Now, people blame that Fox. Of course, people accuse Fox of being, and I look at Fox. My wife is a Fox junkie. Mm-hmm. I mean, seriously, Zuby. She now wants to get the Fox streaming service.
Oh, wow.
And I told her, yeah, not only are you not getting the Fox streaming service, I may call my internet provider and have Fox turned off to you. I know how much Fox she's been watching because I may come home from something I'm doing. And if she's in a bad mood, I can pretty much bet that she's overconsuming Fox for that particular day. Right. So, yeah, I mean, personally, I'll take, you know, I listen to NPR, to Fox, to, I personally like Al Jazeera because I think while it tends to spin things dealing with the Middle East in a particularly kind of pro-Arab way, it deals with European news and American news in actually a pretty fair way.
Yes.
And so online, if I'm just sitting in the office, often I'll stream Al Jazeera and see what their spin is in the world, or I'll listen to NPR and see what their spin is, mm-hmm. or I'll listen to my wife and hear what Fox's spin is. But then I want to do my own research and kind of make up for my own mind what I am, because I look at certain things, I think, you know, almost in a socialist way. And I look at other things in the way that, you know, an independent voter will look at some things, and in other things, you know, I'm a Republican. So, you know, I don't tend to, you know, hang my hat on one particular thing. But yeah, so it's we live in truly, truly crazy times. And, you know, we'll see how it all results.
Yeah, well, I think what you're describing there is simply just being an independent, free-thinking individual, right? Not everything is this false binary, right? It's always trying to be painted as if there's two political opinions out there, right? That's it. There's just two, you know? I mean, and I've said before many, many times that it's crazy to me that in a country of almost 350 million people, there are only two main political parties.
There are only two options.
I mean, that's bonkers to me. There are many countries with a fraction of the population of the USA, and they might have four or five, you know, significant political parties. So at least there is more representation, and it doesn't paint this sort of social picture of there just being these two options, red and blue, you know, right and left, liberal and conservative. Like it's more. Human beings are more nuanced than that, and people's perspectives and ideas are more nuanced. There is gray area. Yeah, some stuff is a bit more black and white, but there's a lot of gray area. And even if people reach similar conclusions, they can have a very different epistemology and pathway to get there. So two people might reach a similar conclusion, but they got there by a very, very different way of thinking and very different reasoning. And all of this nuance is lost when people resort to a very simple binary dichotomy.
Yeah, and then name calling too. Yes. I mean, my observation is on just about any issue you want to make. I mean, religion, politics, social, economic, you name it, that the mentality and sentiment in the United States looks like a traditional bell curve, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got some people way out on the left side of the bell curve. You got some people way out on the right side. But then, you know, the bell curve has this hump, right? Where most people are kind of in the middle, a little bit left, a little bit right, but pretty similar in their consensus, where politically it's a concave curve, where you've got everybody piled up right, everyone piled up left. You look at most major votes that take place in Washington, and it's totally on party line. Yes. Where 20, 30 years ago, you had cooperation, you had negotiation, you had compromise on issues, where you don't have that now. You have somebody comes up for a Supreme Court or a major issue. Mm-hmm. Everyone votes along political lines. It's absolutely crazy. And, you know, if you have more political parties, you end up with a coalition government, which means in the course of 4 years, you don't swing the pendulum way to the left, way to the right, but you moderate change. Mm-hmm. And I think in the process of moderating change, what would happen politically is you build in a bell curve that takes place in centers of power, which tends to more appropriately reflect the sentiment and mood and mentality of the people being governed. Mm-hmm. And really, it shouldn't even be looked at as the people being governed. It really needs to be the people who are administrating the governance that represents the people that are being governed. And that's the ideal. And so I don't know what it's going to take to return the United States to that sort of sanity. But you're welcome to be part of that country if you decide to become a U.S. citizen, like Thank my you. Daughter-in-law decided to be.
Thank you. What do you think it is over the course of decades that has changed it in the way that you are describing? Because you mentioned returning back to how things were previously. What do you think it's changed over the past 10, 20, 30 years that's led to where it is today?
I think it's human frailty, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think it's the sin nature of the human being, and not that people do not have good, positive, wonderful parts. I mean, human beings at the root are, they want good. They want good for their fellow man. But yet, you know, we're fallen creatures. And so I think power, people are driven to power. And they're driven to power to the degree to which a social structure or a political structure allows people to be driven to power. And so I think we've had a bifurcation in terms of power, and it's people that are lining up to grab the power. I think one of the worst things that we have in the United States is that people can become career politicians, and in the process, they can become dirty wealthy. People who go and become lifetime politicians in the U.S. Congress or the U.S. Senate can go there poor and retire millionaires. And, you know, they can do insider trading. I'm a trader. They can be insider trading. They can do them legally. And so they line up for power. And I think what's happened is that special interest groups on the right and on the left. On the right, you may have groups like the pro-gun lobby. On the left, you may have groups like the pro-transgender lobby or the pro-abortion lobby. It tends to be barking and have more and more of an impact in the political process. And so you have wings of government which are tending to play to special interest groups that are out on the fringes rather than reflecting the mood of the people. And I think that's one of the big reasons that we've had it. And I think that's been reinforced by, you know, I think, you know, an inequitable situation economically. I mean, I'm not a socialist. I hate a lot about socialism, but the reality is that income is not that everybody should be fairly appropriated economic means, but I think there's way too much wealth sitting in the hands of special interest groups in the United States, which tends to accentuate what we have as a bifurcated bipolar government.
Yeah. I think one challenge with the USA with everything, and I often have to remind my American friends of this, is that as far as the world is concerned, in terms of global history, the USA is like a teenager.
Yeah.
It's such a young and experimental country. People forget just how recent the country is, and they mm-hmm. forget that it's founded not just along standard borders or ethnicities like most countries is. It's founded on ideals and ideas. And yes, it's taken a long time for those ideals to apply to everybody within the nation. I say a long time. As far as world history goes, it was actually a relatively short time. But I think there are just a lot of growing pains. I feel the same way about social media. People forget that social media and the smartphone combination has mm-hmm. only existed for 16 years.
Yeah.
Right. So all of the screaming and the complaints and this and that about social media, I understand it totally. But I think people forget just how new it is. And it takes time to work things out and to find the right solutions. Right. So there are challenges now that social media is creating that didn't exist in 2010.
Yeah, right?
Just 12 years ago, you know, the technology was there, but it hadn't yet had a time to find, oh, okay, how does this, what are the impact of, oh, there's a whole pandemic situation, right? What's the role of social media in this? Should they be censoring people and banning? Should they be marking things as misinformation or whatever? Should they be fact? Like, to me, this is all kind of experimentation. And so you see the pros and the cons. I don't think when Jack Dorsey started Twitter, and when Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook, I don't think they were thinking, oh, this is a, I'm creating something.
Yeah,
it's going to influence elections and it's going to influence global pandemic policies. Well, no, I think they just thought, oh, I'm just going to make a cool app and people can connect on it and mm-hmm. University students can use it or whatever. And then 14 years later,
yeah.
14, 15 years later, it's like, oh my gosh, like this thing has become this monster with hundreds of millions or billions of users.
Oh, it's crazy.
All this responsibility, and you have governors and presidents and prime ministers who are, you know, making demands of you that Twitter must do this and Facebook. Like, I don't envy those people, man. I mean, I don't think it's quite as simple as people make it out to be. And of course, people are always going to put their ideology into it and their ideas. We're both libertarian leaning individuals, so we, you know, likely think, you know what, just have free speech, right? The Elon approach, right? That's why we're like, cool,
yeah,
right? Just have free speech.
I like
if
that.
It's legal, let people do it. But then there's going to be other people who think, and also different countries have different laws. Here's another thing people forget. So
take
a platform like Twitter. So the USA has its rules around free speech, which that's not the same as Canada, even. That's not mm-hmm. the same as the UK. That's not the same as Germany. It's not the same as the Middle East. It's not the same as Pakistan, whatever. So if you're going to have this global platform, what are the, I don't even know from a legal perspective how that all applies, because something might be illegal in this country. And then in another country, it's like, oh no, that's okay. And how is that all managed and moderated? I don't think it's quite as simple as people would like to think. And I think with Elon taking over Twitter, that's definitely going to be a positive move as far as I'm concerned.
Because
it's gotten far more censorious over time. I've been on Twitter since 2009, so I've really seen these changes.
Yeah, me too.
But I think that, you know, we're never going to get perfect. And I think that's something that humans struggle to accept, is that we're never going to have something that is completely perfect and totally works for everybody. The best we can do is strive to have equality and fairness and apply the same rules and laws to different people and help people out and treat each other with kindness and compassion. But that doesn't mean we're going to get this equality of outcome myth. It doesn't mean that nobody's going to fall behind. It doesn't mean that some people aren't going to be better adapted to certain systems than other people are. That's just the reality of life.
Hey, have you discovered and become a an ardent fan of American football and American baseball yet?
I actually have not. I mean, I they can't even make me an ardent fan of football, which always shocks and disappoints people when they find out that I'm British, because oftentimes the first question used to be, what's my opinion of Brexit? But now the first question is, what football team do I support? And I don't support any football nor American football team. I don't support any professional sports teams. I'm sports agnostic. So
well, you're not exercise agnostic, though.
Oh, definitely.
So
not.
You are
definitely
athletic, not. And you do pursue athletic endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And I used to play sports. You know, I played rugby all the way through to university. I used to play baseball. I used to play football, or what Americans would call soccer. I used to be on a swimming team. I've done all sorts of sports. I've played cricket. I've done rowing. I've done athletics. I've done a lot of different sports over the years. So I enjoy sports, and obviously I'm a big advocate for physical fitness, but I don't get into the pro sports tribalism.
Well, and you talk also about diet, right? I mean, good diet, healthy living, good diet, a lot of tweeting. So what do you do if you're not rapping, you're not traveling, you're not, hey, by the way, your video on pull-ups, I had to watch that more than one time. That was pretty impressive. I got to tell you, that was impressive.
Thank you.
But So what else do you do that bides your time?
Wow. Well, after we've gone through all the things that I do that are somewhat connected to my career directly or indirectly, there isn't that much free time. I like reading books. I like socializing. But honestly, I do so many things that I love, from this podcast to my music to writing, traveling, public speaking, all the fitness stuff. I feel blessed to be in a position to make a good living from all of that. Like right now, I don't feel, as I'm talking to you, I don't feel like this is work. You know,
I'm not talking to you,
okay, I got to go to work, I need to speak to Peter. It's like, no, I'm enjoying this conversation. But yes, this is part of my podcast, so it'll go out there. And people can, thousands of people are going to listen to this. But I enjoy it. If I'm writing a song, if I'm in the studio making music, if I'm doing a performance, or I'm public speaking at an event, I enjoy it. I like it. I like being out there connecting with people. I've really missed that, over the past couple of years, 'cause that was so stifled. I get to see a lot of cool cities and places and countries and meet a lot of people. So things are good. I'm very happy.
Let's say you have a choice. You've got to commit for the rest of your life, the American cuisine or the British cuisine?
American.
Where does American. Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah.
The UK is not world renowned for its palate, right?
My criticisms of American food are more I often say that I think the US has some of the best and some of the worst food in the world.
Yeah.
I just think that there's such a broad range. Mm-hmm. You've got all the like weird processed Franken food, which is full of all sorts of nonsense that's not good for you and is going to make you fat and unhealthy. But there's also a gigantic range of great and nutritious and interesting and delicious food as well. So it's kind of all there in the US, I feel.
Yeah. What about Tex-Mex? What do you think of Tex-Mex?
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's okay. Good. Yeah. Have you been down into the interior of Mexico, though?
No, in Mexico, so far, I've only been to Playa del Carmen and Tulum. Yeah. So what's that area called? Riviera de Maya.
Yeah.
I want to go to Mexico City and a few other places.
Yeah, go to Guadalajara.
Yeah. Guadalajara.
That's where my daughter-in-law, my that married my son, that's where she was. She had to become an American citizen. So she had to go through all of the hoops.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty crazy. You got any opinion of all this immigration stuff that's going on and the big argument over immigration in the United States? Any thoughts?
I haven't looked into it in enough depth myself. I just know what people have told me. And I try not to form strong opinions on things until I've investigated them for myself.
Yeah.
Rather than just going off of hearsay. But yeah, it's a weird issue. It's not something that's new either. I think it just kind of scales up and scales down.
Yeah.
But as far as I remember, my entire life, the U.S.-Mexico border has always been an issue.
Yeah, it has always been an issue. It's always been a political hot potato. Mm-hmm. It's always been a controversy. But you know, I live in a city that's like 45% Hispanic, and mm-hmm. so I live in a county that borders Mexico. And, you know, while there are some issues on the border, there's no question there are some issues on the border, but there's also no question that people from other nationalities have made America what it is, right? I mean, my grandparents came through Ellis Island off the coast of New York City. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a visa. They came into America without a visa. They came into America without a penny to their name. They had mm-hmm. to kind of live the American dream. And, you know, that's gone from people coming to the shore to the United States from Europe and then Asia and then South America and mm-hmm. Africa and, you know, in all sorts of places. And so that's the American story, is people coming here and wanting to make more out of their lives.
Most definitely. Peter, it's been amazing talking to you. What is the best place for people to follow you online?
Well, I can go to @PeterLBrandt. You know, Peter, that's a pretty easy name to spell. The letter L is a pretty easy letter to remember. And then BRANDT. And, you know, they can catch me on a day when I'm writing little scribbles on price graphs talking about Bitcoin. Or they can catch me on a day when I retweet something from the famed Zuby, or they can catch me on a day when I have a comment about the United States efforts against COVID or crazy political things that are going on, at which case usually they better read it, because within an hour or two, usually I take those off and will continue to do so. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Awesome, Peter. Thank you so much for your insights, man. It's been great to finally talk to you. I appreciate
it. Yeah, it's been great. It's been great. Keep doing what you're doing. You're an inspiration to us, Zuby. You have great hip-hop. You've made me a hip-hop fan. Amazing. You've made me a Zuby fan. I don't have a Zuby hat yet, but
we'll get there.
We'll get there. And we'll talk to you again.
Nice one, Peter. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA. From growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.